From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Elise Hugh. It's Here and Now. The campfire in Northern California is still burning. Already, it's the deadliest wildfire in California history, causing at least 42 deaths since it first tore through the town of Paradise on Thursday. Dozens are still missing, and the fire incinerated more than 6,400 homes, forcing residents out of their houses and for an unknown length of time. To talk about this, Casey Hatcher joins us now from Oroville. She's the Economic and Community Development Manager for Butte County, California. That's where you'll find the town of Paradise. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This fire has burned 117,000 acres already. It's still burning. Evacuation orders remain for parts of Butte County. Can you describe what it's like today?
Well, it's the community has been through a lot. It's kind of surreal, honestly. The incident management team, CAL FIRE, put out some information last night where people could start to look up and see the status of their homes. So a lot of people that had thought that their homes were lost have some of that confirmed. Others are still waiting. So people are anxious, but I think it's really just kind of starting to settle.
The people who have lost their homes or have been displaced, where have they gone?
The county has worked to set up shelters. So we have a number of different shelters set up within the county. Our other surrounding counties have been so amazing to help and set up shelters in their communities. So a lot of folks, more than 1,000 people have gone into the shelters, but we're looking at tens of thousands of people that are evacuated here. People are sleeping on couches, staying with friends. Lots of people have left the area. And where people live in the short term and frankly in the long term is still something that we're working out because there's so many homes lost in this fire.
Yeah, because I can't imagine that shelters are able to house people for the long term. So what kind of ideas or options are you thinking of?
There's still certainly an active fire going on and many folks managing the response. But we are now with the federal declaration really switching into recovery mode and putting together one of the task forces that we'll look at is housing. What do we do in the short term? What do we do kind of in the medium term? And then how do we help people rebuild? So there will potentially be a shelter component, and we're still forming up what that's going to look like. Does that mean something similar to what you've seen in other disasters, like trailers on open ground? Mm-hmm. Does that mean a facility that we put up to house people? Really, what does that look like? And we're starting to form those ideas now.
And we can't talk about community without talking about schools. Schools burned down in Paradise. Families are scattered all over the area. Do you know what the plan is for reopening schools someplace else?
We have been working very closely with our school partners, and I certainly don't want to speak for the schools, but I do know that they have put a tremendous amount of thought and effort into this. The schools are closed now through the Thanksgiving holiday, and they are focused on making sure that all of the students that were displaced by this fire have the ability to enroll in school, whether that's in Butte County or somewhere outside of the county. And I know in the coming days, they will be putting out some information about how students and parents should work toward that enrollment.
Air quality concerns also are rising given the ongoing fires, not only in Northern California, but also in Southern California. How is the air where you are?
It's not good. Mm. We've distributed masks, N95 masks, to a number of locations, grocery stores, kind of major outlets, to all of the shelters. People really should be wearing those if they're outside. And frankly, I'm sitting inside of a room and I can see the layer of smoke up on the ceiling.
Wow.
It just really is socked into the valley here. Mm. As the winds have died down, it's not being pushed out. And we really want to make sure people are wearing those masks, specifically if they're in sensitive groups. The air quality is really, really poor, and we want to make sure everyone gets a mask and make sure you're taking care to protect yourself from the smoke.
Casey, a broader question. It's been obviously a devastating week there in Butte County. Some people have lost everything. How does a community recover from something like this?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I think it's one that other communities have certainly had to had to grapple with, and we're still trying to figure that out. But the thing that we have seen more than anything else is that everyone has really come together. You just can't imagine the outpouring of support that we have received from folks within our own county, directly, you know, adjacent to us, from other counties that are probably still recovering from recent fires, whether it's Shasta County or Sonoma County, who have just stepped up and said, we want to come help, we'll be there. And it really gives you the feeling that you can do it, that there's a path to recovery here. And we've started down that. We're certainly still in the incident, but we know we're going to be able to recover from this.
Casey Hatcher is the Economic and Community Development Manager for Butte County, California. Casey, thanks for talking to us during what's obviously such a difficult time.
Thank you so much for having me.
The dust is settling a little bit from last week's elections, at least in Arizona. Last night, Democratic Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema was declared the winner in the Senate race there. Her opponent, Republican Congresswoman Martha McSally, conceded in an online video.
I just called Kyrsten Sinema and congratulated her on becoming Arizona's first female senator after a hard-fought battle.
And could McSally be the second? Let's bring in NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
So you have Kyrsten Sinema, a moderate Democrat, replacing the retiring Republican Trump critic Jeff Flake. But you have to go back to the 80s and 90s for a Democratic senator from Arizona. Big deal?
Yeah, and, you know, it's a big deal for the state of Arizona's politics. It's also a big deal for national politics in what the margin is in the Senate, because after election night, it looked like Republicans could pick up as much as four seats, a net gain of four seats. But then you had Montana Senator John Tester hold on to his seat, the Democrat there. Now you've seen the tide turn where Martha McSally, the Republican in Arizona, had been leading on election night. And now we have Kyrsten Sinema headed for Washington, the Democrat. And Sinema is somebody who ran on this independent message. She's somebody who had certainly been involved in far-left activist politics previously, but ran very strongly on this independent message. And I think it really does show that for 2020, the Southwest in particular is in play for Democrats, and it's something that Republicans and the Trump White House should be concerned about.
And what are the chances that McSally could also go to Washington to replace the late John McCain?
Well, there's that possibility, because right now you have John Kyle, the former senator and current senator, right, who was a lobbyist, who sort of was always seen as a placeholder, replaced John McCain after his passing. And there's the thought that it's potentially possible that if and when Kyle decides to perhaps step aside and not serve out the term, if he wants to go back into the lobbying business, for example, that you could have the Republican governor there, Doug Ducey, appoint McSally.
Okay. To Florida, the statewide recounts for the governor and Senate races go on there. President Trump tweeted yesterday, without any evidence that votes had been forged, Florida governor and, of course, the Senate candidate Rick Scott has alleged rampant fraud. State investigators say they haven't found any. What's the impact when, you know, the party leaders in a democratic society are dissing the process?
Well, yeah, and you had a judge say that the rhetoric should be tamped down and that there hasn't been any evidence of voter fraud to this point, at least on a grand scale. You have Democrats upset over the fact that some 150 ballots were actually emailed from a heavily Republican area, which is against state law, in an area where that was hit by the hurricanes there pretty hard. And the election official there is defending that decision. So we don't know how that'll shake out, but it's only 150 votes or so. But that's something that Democrats are pointing to say, hey, look at what's going on over there. And frankly, it's all a mess. And when you have leaders and statewide officials and presidents saying that, trying to undermine the system, then no one believes the number and the results. And that is foundational to our democracy.
Yeah. We want to ask you as well, the state of Maryland is asking for an injunction today. They're arguing that Matt Whitaker is not the legitimate acting attorney general. Now, we remember President Trump fired Jeff Sessions last week, or as Sessions said in his letter, he stepped down at the president's request. And then the president named Whitaker, Sessions' chief of staff, the acting AG, over the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, which means that Whitaker takes over the Russia investigation, which Rosenstein had been overseeing. So I think we've laid it out there. But what does this mean that Maryland is now saying, no, he's not legit?
Well, you know, I do think it points to the fact that, you know, during the Obama administration, you had a lot of lawsuits that Republican attorneys general had ramped up. And this isn't from the attorney general in the state of Maryland, but from the states. You're going to see a lot more opposition to President Trump and not only his policies, but now apparently his personnel as well.
Yeah. And we just want to ask you about this remarkable series of tweets from President Trump this morning, attacking French President Emmanuel Macron, who over the weekend, we remember, criticized Trump's nationalism, the use of the word, which means something very important, with white supremacy on the rise in and nationalism on the rise in Europe. Trump taunted him, he tweeting things like, make France great again, and tweeting about how during World War II, they were starting to learn German in Paris before the U.S. came along. What's your read on this?
Well, the fact is, President Trump has been somebody who has taken apart something of the, you know, 70-year post-World War II security alliance in this world.
Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor, thank you.
You're welcome.
An estimated 70% of mothers in the U.S. work outside the home. But according to journalist and mom Amy Westervelt, the state of motherhood in America is often miserable, largely because of the expectations put on both mothers and fathers.
Women should parent like they don't work and work like they don't parent. And it extends to men, too. Like, we've done this thing where just as, like, we've sort of allowed women into the workplace but not really accommodated, you know, women's complete lives, we have now asked men to step up as parents, but they are still in this same sort of ideal worker scenario that women are.
Conforming to those expectations for Amy meant taking a single afternoon off to give birth and going back the next day with most of her coworkers unaware that she had even been pregnant. Well, now in her book, Forget Having It All, How America Messed Up Motherhood and How to Fix It, Westervelt says it's time to change those expectations. She says that America's history plays into the way that the country views motherhood and the nuclear family.
There's just this American individualism thing that, you know, has just kind of been there since the beginning, in part because of necessity. You know, if you were here and your extended family was across an ocean, you kind of had to figure it out on your own, and in part because of the Puritan thing that really focuses on each individual person's interpretation of the Bible, abilities to succeed, and that being kind of tied to how good they are as a person and all that kind of stuff, just really got wrapped into this idea that every family is kind of an island unto themselves. And then also, I think motherhood has just always been sort of entwined with capitalism in a weird way in the U.S.
Like what? Can you say a little bit more about that?
Right. You know, we put a big emphasis on competition over care. And that kind of trickles down to this idea that caregiving, you know, we do this thing a lot in the U.S. where we talk about mothers in this way of like, oh, you know, they're nurturers and they're so valuable and the family is so important. But when it comes down to it, we don't give any actual value to caregiving tasks. So, like, there is no monetary support for mothers in any real way. We focus on competition and capital and sort of individual achievement at all costs over the public good.
When we talk about women, you point out numerous times in your book that the dilemma of balancing work and family has a lot less resonance for non-white women, for women of color.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Yeah, I mean, I would say even this whole idea of like the American family, it's so different depending on what background you come from and what, you know, what you saw growing up, what was normal to you, all of that, those kinds of things. And I spoke with a woman who specifically researches black middle class mothers. Her name's Dawn Dow. And she was saying that she found that in most black communities, the idea that you would stay home is actually the weirder thing, you know,
right,
that like
right.
that actually like these are women who've been balancing work and motherhood forever. And it's considered a good thing, a valuable thing that you're modeling that for your children, that you are giving something to the community, that your life isn't just about, you know, you and your nuclear family. It's about a broader community and a broader public. And also, I mean, there's also the fact that in many cases, for both low-income white women and women of color across the board, like there was not really an option to not balance those two things for a really long time.
And you offer a preferred frame of thinking about this that would be more inclusive, called integrated mothering, I guess, or an ideology that you introduce. What is integrated mothering? What does that assume?
It just kind of rejects this dominant idea that work and motherhood are always at odds, that those are two competing forces in someone's life. And it sort of proposes that both of those things have value, that they can coexist in a way that doesn't create tension, and that we should be supporting the existence of both of those things because they both add value to both a woman's life and her family's life and the broader community.
One cool thing about this book is that at the end of each chapter, you offer not just a policy solution, a proposed policy solution, but also a cultural solution, which underlines the fact that even if you do have some sort of top level policy fix, that doesn't necessarily change the culture. And you write about Japan being a good example of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I hear a lot from people who talk about this whole work-life balance, motherhood-work balance thing. The sort of dream is always like, if only we could just be like Sweden, you know? And I'm always like, yeah, sure. But like,
happiest
you know,
people in the world.
Right, sure. But when I started researching the book, I wanted to specifically not point to Scandinavian policies because I feel like there's a cultural mismatch there. And then I ended up doing some research in Japan and realized that actually they had done exactly this thing of like taking Scandinavian policies and plopping them on top of a pretty patriarchal capitalist system.
How did they do that?
It didn't work. So there were several government workers who went and did research in Scandinavia and Western Europe, and they came back with specific policies that they were like, these are the ones that we need to do. And so they rolled out subsidized daycare and equal parental leave for men and women and flex time for working parents of young children and all these things that like we think would be the fix a lot of times.
Yeah, you know, it sounds
like,
great.
So things you hear about, right?
In theory.
In theory, yeah. And what they found was that there just wasn't any uptake of it, in part because the culture hadn't changed along with the policies. So you had these great policies, but you still had a culture that said men are the primary breadwinners and women are the caregivers, and that said there's value to being like the last person at work, you know? And you had this older guard of executive bosses who had not come up working in a system that allowed for balancing work with really any other aspect of life. So it was hard to get them to sort of shift their thinking too. And so it's been about 10 to 15 years now, and they've since had to roll out a lot of sort of like cultural propaganda campaigns.
Okay.
The first was the Ikumen Project. It was to encourage involved fatherhood. So they had a lot of famous men who were dads, you know, that would be on posters and things like that. And there was a big push to include like involved fathers in TV shows and to show rock stars with their kids and all that kind of thing. And then now in the last couple of years, they've rolled out the Iku Boss program, which focuses on kind of retraining these older, mostly men who are in power in most companies to enable their employees to take advantage of some of these policies.
The subtitle of your book, though, is How America Messed Up Motherhood and How to Fix It. So if policy solutions, which you do offer, if policy solutions don't kind of go the whole way, what are changes that should be happening on a personal level? What can a mother such as yourself do to change the way things are to fix motherhood?
Yeah, we do this thing a lot where we kind of expect things to just sort of naturally work out in ways, you know. We have this tendency to think that if you have to try too hard or do anything too sort of practically, that then it's like flawed in some way or it's lame or whatever. But I kind of feel like that's what it takes to actually change things. Like, you do actually have to make a concerted effort to be like, I am going to make sure that my kids don't see me as the one who's always doing household chores, you know. Or I talked to a mom who regularly takes like days away, even when it's not for work, just to like kind of force.
Oh, good for her. Yeah.
I know. I'm like, do it. Just to sort of like force this situation where like she's not the only person who knows how to like be a solo parent to her kids, you know. Or I think I mentioned this in the book. A lot of people maybe don't live near extended family and or, you know, just don't have that kind of relationship with their family. But you can kind of create these bonds with people in your community. So like, for example, I have a couple of my kids' friends who, you know, their parents and I trade off picking the kids up, and sometimes we'll trade off doing like dinners at someone's house or whatever. Just like find ways to kind of create that support system in your own life if it's not being offered to you externally.
You also mentioned having boys do babysitting early on, just in the way that girls do.
Yes, totally. Yeah, yeah. This whole idea that women are somehow like naturally better at dealing with kids is just totally manufactured and perpetuated by the way that we continue to raise kids. So yeah, I mean, having boys babysit is huge. I think, you know, letting boys be maternal in different ways too. Like, you know, my son, when he was like 4 or 5, really wanted a baby doll. And so many people just like squashed that in him. They were just like, oh, no, boys don't have baby dolls. And I was just like, OK, now we know why men aren't good with babies. Like, geez, you know, if like everyone needs to jump on the bandwagon and tell a 5-year-old that it's like not OK for him to have a baby doll, then that seems like a problem to me. If we want to genuinely encourage men to be involved parents and give them the skills to do it.
Amy Westervelt's book is Forget Having It All, How America Messed Up Motherhood and How to Fix It. The book is out this week. Amy Westervelt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
And let's check in now on Wall Street. A day after the Dow Jones fell 602 points, driven by a 5% decline in Apple stock, concerns about a strengthening dollar and Brexit, and reports that the White House is considering new auto tariffs on overseas cars. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Robin.
So Apple, stripped of its golden status as a trillion-dollar company yesterday. What is going on here? Does everyone have their iPhone?
That's one of the things that could be happening. The second one is that a company that makes the technology for the face recognition function has cut its outlook for 2019. Now, this is a company. It's called Lumentum. It deals with a lot of other tech companies, but we know that Apple is probably its biggest customer. So if the person supplying that technology, the company supplying that technology, says things are going to slow down, investors are reading that into Apple slowing down. But again, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Netflix, all of these tech companies which have been riding high for a long time are in correction territory. And that's part of the problem, that the tech stocks that have been, in some people's opinion, overvalued for some time are now coming back down to earth.
We love how you do the detective work here, because apparently this company that makes the facial recognition said it received a request from one of its biggest customers to reduce shipments. And everybody said, that's Apple, you know, and that's kind of the detective work you have to do. But it impacts the market.
Right. And Apple is specifically listed by Lumentum as its largest customer in its annual filing. So it might not be Apple, but if you were Lumentum, you'd want to make sure that you don't mislead the market on this. Or if this happens, you might want to come out and say it's not Apple, and they haven't done that.
Talk about the surging dollar as investors, you know, maybe are looking at European currencies and want to get out of them, you know, because of Brexit coming. They don't know what that means.
Yeah, so there's a couple things going on. The dollar is lower. Stocks have been quite volatile recently. You know, we had big sell-offs. Then we had, you know, prices coming back up. And it seems to move in and around the concerns about rising interest rates in the United States. As our interest rates go higher, as they've been going, the dollar becomes a more attractive currency because all things being equal, if the interest rates are high, you move your money into a safe currency where interest rates are high. You make more money on it. Then there's the idea that other currencies are weakening a little bit. But combine that with this concern about a growing trade war and lump on top of all of that the possibility of a global economic slowdown, which people say may come, and commodity prices are influencing the that thinking. This is all contributing to investors saying, maybe the stock market's not the safest place for me right now.
When you say trade war, it was Axios that first reported that President Trump has been telling his aides that, you know, he thinks that these tariffs on overseas-made cars are, you know, the best negotiating tactics, a 25% tariff. Markets are not liking that.
No, because every time the president threatens that or imposes these things, other countries, and this is the part that he never talks about, other countries impose tariffs on the United States. That's why we have too many soybeans in the United States right now. That's why we have too much bacon. If you're buying soybeans and bacon, that's really good for you. But if you're exporting or you work in these industries and auto, you're a little bit worried. We've got major industrial companies like Caterpillar saying their sales are down, their prices are going up, and that's what's got investors worried.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, explaining it to us. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robert.
It's official. Amazon has confirmed its plans to put major offices in two East Coast cities, one in the Long Island City neighborhood of Queens, New York, and another in the Crystal City area of Arlington, Virginia. It's across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. In its announcements today, Amazon says it could get more than $2 billion in tax breaks between New York and Virginia so long as it hires 25,000 people at each location. The company also announced a new operations center in Nashville with 5,000 jobs. Let's hear more from our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kara Swisher is executive editor of Recode and host of the Recode Decode podcast. Hey, Kara.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So we first learned about Amazon's decision from reporters last week. Does the company making it official tell us anything new or different about the plan?
It's official now that these are the places they're going. I mean, this has obviously been leaked out by them over time, but it's a done deal. This is where they're locating. Shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. We were talking about that it wasn't going to be in a problematic state. And by that, I mean sort of rife with social issues. It was going to be somewhere that was super convenient for its executives and also and where they could find a lot of employees. And these are two spots that sort of meet that need. It's going to definitely impact rents, which are high in D.C., but not as high as, say, San Francisco or other regions.
Yeah, you mentioned that both these cities are already really expensive. They're also struggling to update their transit systems. I mean, you've been on the New York subway and the D.C. Metro.
Right.
So what are these new offices going to mean for infrastructure?
Well, they're going to split them, and so it's 25,000 people. You know, I think it's just bringing more. I don't think it's going to be that big a tax. It's not that many people. Like, it's not 100,000 people or something like that.
Sure.
You know, and this whole headquarters thing, it's not really the headquarters of Amazon. That's going to be Seattle. It still remains Seattle. I've always thought of this thing as a bit of a circus, a three-ring circus with cities, because there's all these other cities who bid and lost. And so there's lots of losers here, you know, in this race. And I'm always questioned if they should be doing any kind of giveaways to the world's richest man, you know.
Let's talk little bit about this whole national sweepstakes aspect.
Yeah.
Amazon was promising, 50,000 new jobs in total to the winner, $5 billion in investments over two decades. We saw more than 200 cities across the country applied for this. And now it turns out the company's going to New York and D.C., essentially. So did Amazon essentially play these other cities to get a better deal?
I don't know. Why wouldn't they make a big deal of it? I don't begrudge them that, but it's just, I think they were going to go where they was good for Amazon, and why not make a game of it, I guess. You know, and interesting, Jeff Bezos has a house that he just bought in Washington, D.C. In a fairly tony area called Kalorama. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty close to, you just cross the bridge right there. I just did it the other day. It's a really quick commute to where it is, to this house he's got here.
Kara, you also have a story up on Recode this week, and we'll link to it at hereandnow.org. You write in this piece that local retail still has advantages that Bezos can't replicate. Like what?
A dwindling number of them. I just bought a house in D.C. myself, thank goodness, before Amazon got here. I live here part-time because my kids are here, but I've been buying some things for the house, which I haven't done in a while. I have a nice place in San Francisco. And so it was really interesting to try to not use Amazon because it was so convenient. It had such the advantages of data and customer service and delivery. And they really don't get anything wrong. It's really quite astonishing how few mistakes Amazon makes, given the volume that they do. And so I was trying really hard to do local retailer, and especially with the chains like a CB2 or something like that, I had real problems with them. They delivery costs were high. They got things wrong. It was hard to reach them, and they just haven't gotten up to Amazon speed in that thing. And so then I found some local retailers, and certain things they were doing I thought were particularly interesting, like one local hardware store called Logan Hardware. I'm in the Shaw Logan Circle neighborhood.
Yeah.
The customer service was superb. You walk in and what do you want? And then if they don't have it, they call upstairs. You get to the top of the stairs, another person's there to help you. And so I thought that was important, this human touch, that in Amazon, you're never speaking to a human, really. And then in another store, there was incredibly unique products. It's called Miss Pixies. And Amazon will never be able to create that kind of store, the quirky, unusual, weird objects, all based on taste, you know, of the person who's running the store. Probably could get a lot of those things Amazon, but it would have taken me for, I wouldn't have found them. I wouldn't have happened upon them. And so I'm relying on the curation, the experiential curation of a store so that you enjoy it more. But I got to say, even in these stores, they were like, we're getting killed by Amazon. Mm-hmm. The people walk in now and they don't even bother to pretend they're not ordering it right in the store. They see something, take a picture of it, order it on Amazon. That has changed the game a lot for these retailers.
That's Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode and host of the Recode Decode podcast. Kara, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot.
Blaine, Washington is a small town along the border with Canada. And thanks to Amazon and other mail order companies, Blaine is one of several small border towns that's turning into a P.O. box for Canadians. Sweetgrass, Montana, Champlain, New York, and Blaine are home to a remarkable jump in the number of mailbox stores catering to Canada's online shoppers. Tom Bonsi from the Northwest News Network explains the e-commerce shipping game that Canadians play.
It feels like Christmas all day long in Blaine, Washington, where Interstate 5 meets the Canadian border. There are parcels to open, pretty things to unwrap.
These are the first ever women's LeBron James shoes. It's my daughter's birthday tomorrow.
G.V. Hare patronizes Hagen's of Blaine, one of 15 private mailbox or parcel receiving stores in this small border town. Hare is from British Columbia. Like the vast majority of other customers at the parcel stores that dot the downtown, for him, it's cross the border or no collector Nikes.
These shoes are only available in the U.S., so you need to have an American address for the company to ship to. So from Canada right across the border, so we just make our way over and get the parcel and go back.
Wider online product selection is among the most common of many reasons Canadians give for paying for a mailing address across the border. Another is to avoid the expense of international shipping. I met Ryan Matthews of Surrey, British Columbia, as he was unpacking two custom skateboards.
Another beautiful board.
Yeah. Most online vendors ship for free within the continental United States. Yeah. Blaine is very much part of that. Okay. And it saves us brokerage charges. That's the reason.
Among the products that may cost more when ordered from Canada are electronics, collectibles, and some clothing. The visiting parcel picker-uppers have to declare their goods at the border on the way home and often pay customs duty then. Canadian Sharon Bentley has lots of experience doing this.
I was crossing the border trying to figure out where my parcel's at, and it was quite complicated because I had to rush after work, and they closed at 6 o'clock, and I'm trying to rush over, border lined up, and all that stuff.
In self-defense and sensing opportunity, Bentley and her brother started a business in Blaine called Parcel 24/7. It has aisles of self-service lockers. Over the past 5 years, the business has grown from one location to four, stretching all the way to Niagara Falls, New York.
So, like, some people drive 2 hours to us. Yeah. And then they make a range, like a weekend trip, and then when they come down, and then they do the gas and the Costco and all that stuff, right, in one shot. Yeah.
When Wall Street traders play this game with currencies and commodities, it's called arbitrage. On the U.S.-Canada border, it's a windfall for city governments. In Washington state, sales tax is calculated at the point of delivery. Therefore, Blaine got about $120,000 last year from its share of the sales tax on online purchases, paid mostly by Canadians. City manager Michael Jones says there can be too much of a good thing.
Having a lot of these package delivery stores, the mailbox stores, is a great thing. They're bringing in money for our bottom line.
That said, the Blaine City Council this summer voted 7-0 to exclude new parcel pickup businesses from downtown.
In order to make sure that we don't become a downtown that's just full of mailbox stores, now there, we can still have more in other locations, and the ones that are already here can continue to operate.
Jones says city leaders are mindful their good fortune could change due to factors outside of their control, something private mailbox store owners told me as well. They keep an eye on the exchange rate. Then there's trade tensions. International shipping could get cheaper or border crossing more difficult. And e-commerce giant Amazon is building more warehouses inside Canada. All that could make a future trip for a pair of LeBron James sneakers less attractive. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi reporting from Blaine, Washington.
And we're getting details this week on what Britain's divorce from the EU, Brexit, might look like. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has been in frantic meetings over the last few days to try to work out a deal her government and members of the European Union will agree to ahead of the March deadline for Britain to leave the EU. Jeremy Hobson is in London. He'll be broadcasting from there tomorrow and Thursday. Jeremy, you are perfectly positioned, as usual. So what's the latest there?
Well, we've been waiting for days now to figure out exactly whether Theresa May can come up with a deal with the European Union on what a Brexit would look like. The question all along has been deal or no deal. Are they going to reach a deal and come up with the rules and regulations of what's going to happen if they Brexit? Or is there going to be no deal and they'll just crash out of the European Union? And just in the last few hours this afternoon, she has presented a deal to her cabinet, or she is in the process of doing that. Members of Parliament are going to be going over to Downing Street tonight to find out what exactly this deal looks like. Robin, we're getting a few reactions to it, just to the leaks of it, and it looks like the Conservatives, that's her party in Parliament, are not that pleased with it. Boris Johnson, her former foreign minister, who left her cabinet in protest of what was going on, he has said that it would be unacceptable to be sort of beholden to Brussels in a deal, which makes you think maybe this is a softer Brexit than some had hoped. We've been on down at Westminster today talking to members of Parliament. I want you to listen to Kenneth Clark, who's a Conservative, but he doesn't want to Brexit. He's upset about the whole referendum. Here's what he told us about whether he knows anything about what's going to happen next.
Anybody who tells you that they're confident they know what's going to happen is deceiving themselves. I have never seen a bigger shambles in all my life. I don't think the principal parties engaged know exactly what's going to happen.
So that's what you're hearing from even somebody in Parliament. Right, exactly.
Right. So, look, just remind us, what's at stake? I mean, when you say crash out in March if there's no deal, I mean, there's trade issues between Northern Ireland and Ireland. What's at stake here?
Well, I mean, that is the thing that everybody has been watching, is what is a Brexit, especially a crash out, no deal Brexit, going to mean for the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland? As you know, Robin, Northern Ireland is part of the UK. Ireland is not part of the UK, but they're on the same island. And since the 90s, they've had kind of a very soft border between the two of them. They can move goods and people back and forth. The question is, would that remain if there's no deal? So that's a big sticking point. And would peace be preserved in Ireland and Northern Ireland if there's no deal? Our colleague Peter O'Dowd has been in Northern Ireland. He's been reporting from there. We're going to hear his story about that tomorrow. But even in the UK, there's a lot at stake. In Great Britain, there's a lot at stake. In Europe, there's a lot at stake. And of course, everybody's watching the markets around the world, even in the United States. Whatever happens is going to have implications.
Yeah. So look, this idea of Brexiting won the referendum, but as we're hearing, people are now kind of saying, we're not so sure we like this. Are you hearing from people who are still for it?
Yes, and we're hearing from people who would, one of the conversations has been, should there be a second referendum? Let people have another chance to say if they really want to Brexit. And many of the people we've been talking to have said that would be a betrayal of the first one because it wasn't best of three. It was, do you want in or do you want out? This is another member of parliament we were talking to today, John Redwood, who's also a conservative, but he wants to leave the EU even if it means crashing out in March without a deal. Here he is.
So would you be okay with... sooner we are out, the better, which is what I and most Leave voters are urging the government to do. Just go away on the 29th of March, 2019, as we are legally entitled to do, and sign no withdrawal agreement because it's a rip-off.
Okay, so he thinks it's a ripoff, Robin, but a lot of people think that that would be an absolute disaster, would plunge this country into chaos, and that there would be ripple effects all across Europe.
Just go away. look, you were in Paris. What did people there say?
Well, you know, I heard a very common French phrase when I asked people what they thought, which was this. Just you could just see the person holding the cigarette and saying that to me. But they said to me, look, this is what the Brits wanted. They're getting what they wanted. We don't think it's a good idea. We wish that they weren't doing this. But if they are going to do it, we need to figure out a way to have a real relationship with the United Kingdom. They're right next door to each other. You know, they've had a lot of history of conflict over the centuries, and they want to make sure that they have a good economic relationship and a good relationship in general with the United Kingdom. So they're hoping that there's a deal. In France, I think that they would be very upset if there's no deal.
Well, now we have the opposition Labour Party spokesperson on Brexit saying that he doesn't think that this is the right deal. What happens? They do another one? I mean, what happens?
Well, what could happen is that Theresa May will no longer be the prime minister. It depends. I mean, this is a domestic political issue for her in a big way. She doesn't have the support among conservatives right now for this deal. She certainly doesn't have the support among Labour for this deal. So it's going to be a question over the next few days are who's going to back away first? Who's going to give in and say, okay, fine, we'd rather this than nothing?
Here now is Jeremy Hobson in London. He'll be broadcasting from the BBC the next couple of days, perfectly positioned for this story. And also, we're going to get to meet your grandmother.
That's right. She lives in the UK. We'll hear from her this week.
Can't wait. Jeremy, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. We want to thank NPR's Elise Hugh for playing on our team for a couple days. Thank you.
Well, thank you guys, and thanks to the team for welcoming me.
I'm Robin Young.
This is Here and Now.